Hey everybody, welcome to part two of the Relationship Daily Double, which we explained in, interestingly enough, part one. So I would say, if you're dropping in here, great, but you do want part one of this because, Tori, the way you've put these together is they're kind of a package deal.
You'll see why they work together. They're both relationship focused, practical advice, but they're hitting you, I think, at two different parts of the road. But I think you need them together. Say, listen through to this, but then jump back to episode one and listen to Tony Newhoff.
Yeah, you really do want to listen to both parts of this. But now here we are in part two. So Dr. Emerson Eggerichs, he's a New York Times bestselling author. The book that I think he's most known for is Love and Respect. He's a communication expert. He's an internationally celebrated expert on so many of these topics and is really passionate about what he does and is also just has so much information to share. When I think about somebody who's been doing this for decades as a counselor, and that alone intrigues me. Is it fair to say that, like, you can't hardly keep up with like his connection to biblical text? I mean, he's moving fast, and there's a lot of, this is grounded in scripture, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, you'll hear this in the episode. He'll be talking and we'll just, in a sentence, just mention a verse and just weave it in and keep moving. So you can tell he's not making this up. If he's coming right at this from experience, but also biblical truth, and he's connecting those two so that, I mean, with all advice, especially relationship advice, there are times I'm sure something will be a little poignant. And I think sometimes our first reaction can be to dismiss it and to say, oh, I don't need that, or they don't know about my life, or they don't know about right my marriage. But I think right that's often sometimes a clue that we need to be leaning in of, like, what's bothering me in this episode might be something I need to be paying attention to.
Yeah.
Because it might be really relevant to me and I don't want to brush it off.
Well, and I would even, let's back it up a sentence or two and say that because this is grounded in what I'm calling scripture, I know that some of you who listen to this podcast are at this point going, well, I don't know that that's a credible source for me yet. I'm still trying to figure that out. I would encourage you, even you, to listen and see, you know, Tori, what you're talking about, is there a practical application to my life, to my relationships? I'd lean in and listen because it might begin to lead you towards considering these scriptures and do they have value and do they speak truth? As you listen to Emerson just explain in real world terms how relationships work, how communication and just the dynamic between a husband and a wife, how it flows and how it's better to engage in, like, moments of conflict, which are always going to come up. I think it's just really helpful. And, you know, I think Emerson would say this, that it's not like there's a cookie cutter, here are the three steps to making this work. But what he's giving us are some handles that will help us to consider how to do this.
I think also encouragement. If it's not just, this isn't just a teacher coming at you and telling you what you need to change and what you need to be working on. There's encouragement right of him saying, I've seen this work in his own marriage with Sarah.
That's right.
He tells stories about when it worked right well, that's and right when it didn't work well. It's helpful.
I appreciate that, by the way. It's helpful, and I would say hopeful, which is why it's such a good connect with part one, because I think both of these guests, even though they're speaking truth, hard truth sometimes about, you know, conflict and the how intentional you have to be to build into a marriage, a relationship with someone, there's hope. Just because you're on the edge of things falling apart doesn't mean that you have to go over that edge. And maybe that's the thread for me, is that there really is encouragement for people who are on the edge to back away from the edge and to lean into their relationships, which is why this Daily Double makes so much sense to me. And I think it was a great idea on your part to package them together. So since we've heard part one, let's jump into part two of this Daily Double with Dr. Emerson Eggerichs. Many relationships, I'm marriages for sure, but friendships, parental relationships, they aren't what they used to be. They're showing signs of stress. Some have gotten better and deeper and richer as I've had conversations with people, and some have become frayed and people are exhausted. Would you talk to us about how times of stress, trauma, loss, take your pick, how they either bring people closer together or they widen the divide?
Well, I think to your point, isn't it? You're accurate. And, I would concur with what you're saying. And I think most of us recognize that these situations either bring out the best of ourselves or unfortunately the worst of ourselves. And this becomes a challenge to all of us because that confinement is something that has either caused many of us to come closer together in very rich and meaningful ways. You hear so many testimonies of one couple told me that, she had her husband home during that whole time and just with him and just the joy that brought her, but they're in a little bit of a later season of life. They don't have the little ones running around. But you had many testimonies like that people are just saying it's just short of pure joy for us. And we have a principle that we call my response is my responsibility. And in my relationship with Sarah, I say my response is my responsibility. So Sarah doesn't cause me to be the way I am. She reveals the way I am. And so when my response, let's say, is unloving, it reveals that I've made a decision to be unloving. But most people are like me. I come up with every justification for blaming Sarah for my negative reaction. And in fact, I have a tendency to demonize her at moments in order to motivate her to be like an angel. and I negatively react in these moments to try to motivate her or others around me to be positive. And one day when that hit me, I thought, wait a minute. I mean, why is it that I can negatively react with the idea that that's going to motivate everybody to start treating me positively? But when they negatively react to me, they're out of line.
But it doesn't work. It's cyclical in how that happens. How do you break that cycle?
Well, it's this idea that we are defensively reacting quite often in these confined moments where we're feeling frustrated, we're feeling anger, we're feeling, annoyed, irritated, and we negatively react. In some ways, it's a defensive reaction. I mean, it's kind of like, I've had enough here. I can't handle this anymore. Please stop, and what we don't realize, though, is that defensive reaction ends up offending. So we are defensive, but we really are offensive. But we expect the other people to decode that I'm being defensive and I'm feeling like my air hose is being stepped on and I'm suffocating. So we push them off our air hose and we end up severing it, if not just standing on their air hose. And that's where the cyclical component comes in. We keep negatively reacting to each other. That puts us on what I call a crazy cycle with the thought that our spouse is going to have this light bulb moment where they're going to come running into the room the next day. I had an epiphany. What? I now realize why you were negatively reacting to me on an ongoing basis during this pandemic. Why? To motivate me to be positive.
Yeah.
But that negativity keeps happening because we keep expecting the other person to decode why we're negatively reacting. And we expect them to change their behavior. But the challenge for all of us is, hey, if I'm not responding positively to their negative reactions to me, what makes me think, unless I'm extremely self-centered, that my negative reaction is going to motivate them to be positive? And this becomes the real challenge because we're on this crazy cycle. It's spinning. This negativity keeps triggering and feeding itself. Someone's going to have to stop that. And if we keep, reacting even louder, and it doesn't go anywhere. So then I have to step back and say, you know what? This is deeper than just my spouse mistreating me. This is really me being out of control. And that's a deeper issue. And unfortunately, many of us don't want to acknowledge that. We want to say, you caused me to be the way I am.
So what I'm hearing, though, is sounds beautiful. I'm guessing that you're going to tell me that this isn't something that you're going to just come to in the heat of the moment. There has to be some pre-work or some pre-thought on this in these times of stress and loss. And how do we talk about this before we get to that moment? Is that where we start?
Well, exactly. It's called rules of engagement. I always say to people, most people that I talk to are extremely skilled and knowledgeable in an area of expertise. They're very good a lot of times in parenting, definitely in their area of employment, that they've developed this knowledge and skill. If they're in sales, they know that there's going to be these moments where someone really pushed back, calls them, you know, impure in their motives. I mean, they have been prepared to deal with all those negative, you know, rejections or, you know, whatever the case. It's amazing to me just how skilled people really are. It doesn't make any difference how knowledgeable we are. Somehow in relationship to this person we married, we're very vulnerable and we end up pouting. We react in these teenage ways and we don't stop and think, you know what, if I keep doing what I have been doing, I'm going to keep getting the same negative results. The best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. So there comes a moment where I have to say, you know what, we got to talk about this. We've got to have a rules of engagement. Somehow this isn't working. Neither one of us are happy. We can keep making the point. And this can be crazy for 30 years, or one of us can say, can we do this differently? And not so much because we're blaming the other person, but because you say, you know, it's not fair of me to treat you this way. I've got to do this differently. And will you give me a chance to do that? And there has to be a thoughtful commitment to do it. You can't do this just by accident. As I say, you don't parent in the spare time. You can't do marriage in your spare time. There comes a moment when we make a commitment to have some kind of a rule. So if the couple has continued to escalate and we're demonizing each other and we're shouting each other to stop shouting at each other, there comes a moment when two mature people have to say, you know, we're better than this. We've got to come up with some kind of a rule that we're willing to explore and experiment with. So one of the things Sarah and I try to do is introduce frequency, not duration. In other words, we know moments get crazy on a regular basis. We're not frightened of that. We have these moments because it comes at us sideways. We don't get freaked out by that, but we don't freak out either. My dad had rage issues. We don't go into the rage thing, but we have this methodical way. Okay, I'm going to take a break to calm down. I come back for 15 minutes. If she doesn't get everything, you know, addressed, well, we can address that later. But she needs to reassure me that I'm not going to be overwhelmed and flooded again because we're going to be right back where we started.
Well, here's what I would say as I'm hearing you talk about this, though. Even the commitment to the process, as imperfectly as we do it, especially at the beginning of learning this, even that begins to build a kind of trust. If I tell someone, hey, I need 15 minutes and then I'll be back, if I come back, I'm showing a kind of credibility that I'm actually committing to this. Even if we don't get through something, it sounds to me like how we do this is a way of beginning to build a kind of trust in the system and in each other so that we can keep navigating this further out, because we're not going to figure it all out in one conversation.
That's correct. The issues are going to be endless over the lifetime. I mean, we're going to go from one issue to another. That's just normal stuff, and we mustn't be frightened of that. But if we don't have rules to referee it, because the rules need to be the bad guy. So when that conflict comes, the rule makes that decision. Can we come up with an honorable rule here that honors you, but also honors me? In this case, there's nothing in scripture that talks about the 15-minute rule, but it certainly makes a lot of sense to people who need to do what you're saying. We need to make a commitment to a process. And that commitment is made by all of us, Sarah and myself. We've been married nearly 50 years. I've written many books on marriage. We have made a commitment to have this rules of engagement because we need those. It doesn't in any way suggest that you are a bad person. It means that when we get in these moments, we're vulnerable to the criticism of the other person because we're actually one. And therefore, their opinion of us, we're much more vulnerable to than perhaps to any other person. And it is. And we're going to react like teenagers at times. So we need to guard against that by making a commitment up front in those non-emotional times about how we're going to deal with this. Now, if we are presumptuous and arrogant, oh, we don't need to do that, well, then how's it going for you, as Dr. Phil would say? If it's not working, my strong recommendation is try this for a while. And don't do it and etch it in concrete, so to speak, or stone. You know, try it for 6 weeks and then make some adjustments.
Okay, so there's something very intentional. There's an intentionality to this. I've heard you talk about the importance of pacing yourself and making sure that your spouse isn't getting your leftovers. I can't help but think that this is connected in some ways, but could you just talk about when we just give our spouse the leftovers? What do you mean?
Well, I think Sarah and I, back to the 15-minute period that worked for us, Sarah was trying to access me, and respectfully so. When she would access me during transitions, when I was leaving to go to church, I pastored for, you know, 20 years, and I'd go down to be in study for the sermon prep for that next Sunday, and she would see me getting ready to leave, and well, I'm preoccupied, but she felt that she could then give voice to the things that she was feeling when I went to the door. Well, I was mentally already gone. I was already beginning to think through, you know, and so that created even more tension for us. And so here again, we backed away, and I figured out, okay, is Sarah a good-willed woman? And is she pulling on me because she's trying to irritate me or annoy me? No, apparently she has a need, and I'm the only one that can meet that. And I framed it from the standpoint that really I was the only one that could meet this emotional need for connection or at least information. I mean, Dr. Deborah Tannen, the linguist, says women need to give the report to build rapport, that Sarah had a need that I didn't necessarily have, but she had that need to connect emotionally. So we stepped back and I said, what if I give you every night 15 minutes after dinner and the kids are, you know, out playing there or whatever they're doing, where we're going to be in the bedroom 15 minutes and I just listen to you for the day. And that just took a weight off of Sarah, like unbelievable. Now she had a predictable time. She didn't feel like it was the leftovers, or she was trying to somehow, if it's not leftovers, trying to respectfully access me when I really didn't want to be accessed. A lot of times men come home and want to move into frivolity. They don't want to re-engage everything. They want to disengage. So you've got to come up with some plan that's win-win. I'm writing a book now based on 1 Corinthians 7 called The Win-Win Marriage, that thoughtful people with knowledge and skill say, you know what, we need to do this differently because what's going on is just annoying both of us and we can do it better. But what we also have to think through, men in particular, this isn't asking you to go 15 hours every day in a conversation. The proposal in this case was for 15 minutes, but I committed every day to that. So it came back to frequency, not duration. And I challenge men to be thoughtful. You don't have to apologize for saying this is overwhelming to me. I don't want to talk for an hour every evening. But at the same time, to say to her, I'm not going to talk to you each evening because it's not a need in me. And your wife is saying she needs to connect you, which is not a complaint, but a compliment. What's fair here? And what's fair is to propose something that's win-win. It's not asking you to make too much of a sacrifice. It's not asking you to give what you can't give, but it is saying give a little bit more than you have. Based on 1 Peter 3:7, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way so that your prayers may not be hindered. And that was a verse that really awakened me to God's calling me to be understanding of Sarah. Even though I didn't have her feminine concerns, I knew the Lord was asking me to do that because I was the Christ figure, Sarah was the church figure, and the Lord was saying, if you don't listen to her as the Christ figure, I'm not going to listen to your prayers as the true Christ over your life. And that really spoke to me because the correlation is not with a happy marriage resulting from your being understanding. The result is effectiveness in prayer. And I sometimes say to men, you walk in integrity in every area, but you say, no one can understand this woman. Well, then Peter says you're under divine command to do that. And furthermore, just test it out. Start to be more empathetic with her concerns, try to validate her concerns, and then pray about something the next day unrelated to the marriage and watch if the Lord doesn't favor you in that time of petition.
And it seems like as we're coming out of this time when people were spending, you know, so much of their waking days and working weeks, really, in the same house, we're going to have to now renegotiate, navigate. We're going to have to talk openly and intentionally about this again as people, and many are both spouses are working, and so you're now back out in the world, and all of this now has to be renegotiated as we re-enter this world.
So I think people have this Hollywood image rather than a Holy Word image. That relationship, if you just love everybody, if you just love each other, that's all that matters. And all of this will work itself out. I just don't believe that's wisdom. Iron sharpens iron. If 1 Corinthians 7:28 says, if you marry, you've not sinned, but you will have trouble, that there are added responsibilities. There are things that arise. There are unexpected things. A five-year-old child could get cancer and you have to do the hospital scene for months on end. life is not this Hollywood image always. And so I want to say to people, don't feel ashamed by hearing what I'm saying in terms of thinking through strategies to deal with the negativity that is going to arise. And don't conclude you made a mistake in marrying that person or that you don't love each other enough. That is a very superficial assessment. I call it the 80-20 rule, that 20% of that relationship is going to have responsibilities that end up coming across, you know, in ways that are more than what we were wanting. We don't want this right now. This isn't what we want. But that's just part of, and here's the deal. The more responsible people are, the more that's going to happen, particularly in that midlife where you're responsible for your aging parents, you're responsible for your kids, you're responsible for everything. There's a little privilege. And this is the greatest challenge for your maturity. And so therefore, it's all the more important not just to think that if we love each other, we should be able to do this spontaneously without any real trouble or without any real tension. I just don't think that is biblical, and it's certainly not going to be confirmed by any research on marriage dynamics.
Okay, so let me ask you a specific question about communication and the difference between communication and understanding, because a lot of times people say we need to communicate better. But you make a distinction between these. Can you talk a little bit about that and how, even behaviorally, how do we know that what will I be doing differently when I am understanding someone better? Talk to us a little bit about how we can make these distinctions.
Right, and that's an excellent point. And I talked about the fact that many people say communication is the key to marriage. But I point out that really that's very, very important. But I would say more importantly or more fundamental, more foundational, is that there needs to be mutual understanding. And the word picture or the analogy I give is I can speak perfect Spanish, and my prose to Sarah in Spanish could almost be poetic, and every Spanish-speaking person would say, he communicated that perfectly. But Sarah doesn't speak Spanish. She's German, and she only speaks German. So she sees my lips move, and she can hear this sound, but she doesn't have any understanding. So my perfect communication, where I think it's perfectly clear, isn't going to get through because she doesn't understand the meaning behind my words. And vice versa, German toward me, who only speaks Spanish. Now, people think, well, but we're both speaking English. Well, for instance, the research points out that during conflict, men withdraw. And we withdraw. We pull away to de-escalate. We're sending a message. I do not want to fight. I'm protecting you and I'm protecting me. In our world, Greg, that is a clear message. And the research was borne out where they studied these 2,000 couples for 20 years at the University of Washington. 85 out of 100 men during a marital conflict will withdraw. Okay, that is significant, off the charts significant. The women were asked, when he does that, what do you feel? The response was so consistent, they made a descriptor called an act of hostility. In her world, the meaning was clear. He hates me. This is a hostile action. That's a protective instinct. But when that happens to him in a conflict with his wife, he doesn't want to fight with her because she's not the enemy. So in his mind, and say it to his best buddy, we're not enemies. So what do? You separate. So it raises this question. When both are communicating, not necessarily verbally, he's quiet, but he's sending a message. She's trying to interpret that message. To her, it's an act of hostility. To him, it's an act of honor. The flip side of that research pointed out that during these conflicts, women will criticize and complain. The men were asked, you know, what do you feel during that time? And basically, she's using this conflict as an opportunity to send me a message that she has contempt for who I am as a human being. That's what he hears. We all know from social research that women are nurturers. Women can't not care. And every woman who's moving toward her husband in this complaining, criticizing is because she cares. She cares. Now, her methodology may not be the best any more than his withdrawing may be the best, but the message she's sending is I care. The message he hears is you have contempt. The problem is we're not speaking the other's language. When we're in a foreign country and no one speaks our language, we start getting louder. And so too in the marriage, when we sense that they're not understanding us, we start getting louder as though somehow that decibel raising that is going to clarify the communication. And we're seeing this across the world, where couples are trying to say things as clearly as they can, but the other isn't hearing it, so they start yelling and screaming. And my mission is to say, look, if you're married to a person of goodwill, then my prediction is you're both trying to send each other a message based on that goodwill, but it is through a language that neither one of you understand.
So I want to ask you now about people who there's someone listening who feels discouraged and they're really wondering if this is past the point of no return in a relationship. What do you say to somebody who has lost hope or is losing hope? And are we counting the cost of this as we go through this? Would you speak to that if you could, Emerson?
The person who's feeling hopeless right now, there would be one of two reasons that they're feeling hopeless. There's betrayal, that there's been adultery, there's been some immorality and evil, and that is problematic. And I get that. There's the scripture talks about the fact that adultery can break that covenant and just leave you in a hopeless state. And that is very serious. And scripture acknowledges the seriousness of that. Isaiah talks about our wife who's rejected and the pain of that. But many people come to a point where there isn't anything immoral. You know, I'll say to people, has somebody committed adultery? No, no, no. What has happened over 10 years, they've had these ongoing clashing preferences. You know, they just see things differently, and it just kind of fuels this ongoing debate and argumentation. And they get to a point where they don't like each other, and it's like they feel like they don't matter to the other person. We get derailed because of these honest misunderstandings again. There are ways that you can move forward. There can even be ways of seeking forgiveness. But one of the beginning points is if you realize your spouse's spirit continued to deflate, you could introduce something new. When you see his spirit deflate, say to him, you know, I just learned something the other day. I think I'm coming across you in a way that dishonors you and disrespects you. That's not my intent. Is that what you feel when I come at you this way? So too, the man listening, you know, the next time you see her just shut down, it's probably not on the issue. She's not shutting down on your advice. No, it was your harshness, your appearance of being hostile and unloving. So if you said, you know what, wait a minute, time out here. Will you forgive me for coming across in an unloving way? That was not Christ-like. The Lord spoke to me about that. So part of what I say to people who feel helpless is, I personally think many times we're in that situation because we don't have the knowledge or the skill. We got derailed and we didn't know how to get back on the rails. It has nothing to do with the fact that your spouse has ill will, has nothing to do with the fact that you have ill will. It has nothing to do with the fact that you don't matter. You have to then step back and ask, am I married to a person who has basic goodwill? So I help people reframe, redefine these dynamics. And it's amazing, Greg, some people's relationship turns around in 24 hours once they realize they could have done this for 30 years.
Yeah. That gives us a hope that we take some of these steps and this happens. But there is a pain.
I believe if you do what God's calling you to do, you will be faithful unto death. The problem, of course, is that when you word it that way, it's kind of like you're saying marriage is all hell kind of a thing, you know, and we don't want to frame it that way. But we do want to say this is no small issue. And so, but if you devote yourself to this, you bring pleasure to Christ. You are doing something that demonstrates profound maturity. The Lord said, I'm watching. This is very important. And the husband-wife relationship is where he watches. So when you put on love, you're doing it because you've chosen to love Jesus Christ as a mature man, because you're an honorable man, and because you realize this demonstrates that you are, I don't want to say it because it sounds so silly, sainthood. And so too, ladies, when you respectfully confront things, especially when your husband appears to be unloving, but you confront the issue respectfully without becoming contemptuous, and you do this as to the Lord, as to Christ, because you love Christ and reverence Christ, you're entering sainthood. And this just reinforces the fact that this is never easy. You have brought pleasure to Christ. He's watching this, and he's pleased with this, that at the end of the day, it isn't about my spouse per se, it's about Jesus Christ and doing what he calls us to do.
As unto the Lord. That's good. That's good. Tell me one, like, what's something you and your wife, Sarah, did that strengthened your marriage?
The fact that Joy, my daughter, and her husband with two children were able to come from Paris, France, and quarantine here with us for 6 months. You know, just the joy that we had in being able to have them here is really a gift that God gave to us. And would that strengthen our marriage? It brought a joy to us that I think we would not have had they not been here. And I think some families need to be reminded that where you're all huddled together, you're going to look back on your deathbed as perhaps that was the most precious gift that God could have ever given to you. And you went through the whole thing irritated.
Oh, wow. 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 Yeah. Let's not miss those opportunities when we're actually in each other's presence. Emerson, thank you for being with us. Thank you for sharing your heart, your insight, your years of experience, and really clinical wisdom, I think, interwoven with biblical principles. And so just thank you for talking to us and speaking into marriages and relationships. And God bless you. We can't wait to hear about the new book and to look at it, and just pray that it is everything that you and God are working on together these days. So thank you for joining us. Thanks for listening to A Godzillion in One podcast. Subscribe, share this episode with a friend, and head over to gregholder.com for the show notes. And as always, stop and notice this week the shockingly and seemingly endless ways to connect with each other, this world, and the God who made it all. We'll see you next time.